From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And in the first part of today's show, we're going to be speaking with David Lipsky, an award-winning journalist and author of the book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial.
In it, Lipsky explores how anti-science became popular in American life. He outlines the history of climate denial and its consequences. Climate change has become an unavoidable fact and an ongoing catastrophe. The science was clear decades ago. How did so many Americans come to doubt evidence so widely accepted and compelling? David Lipsky in his book, The Parrot and the Igloo, in the first part of the show.
And then we'll talk with Daniel Kinka, who is the senior wildlife restoration manager at American Prairie. He'll be discussing his work restoring and monitoring wildlife on a nearly half-million-acre Montana reserve. Kinka also acts as a liaison to scientists conducting research at the reserve. He'll be discussing the latest projects that they're working on there as well.
And joining us in the first part of the show is David Lipsky. He's a journalist and author of a number of books. His most recent one is titled The Parrot and the Igloo, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. David, thank you so much for joining us. Well, let's start here. Your book, The Parrot and the Igloo. Let's go back, David, to those halcyon days when scientists and inventors like Michael Faraday and James Maxwell and Thomas Edison and Westinghouse and Tesla, despite some of their personality quirks and characters, they were well-respected, highly credible human beings across Europe and North America. Do I have that kind of right?
You do. And there was an innocence about celebrity in the 19th century that you kind of miss when you're getting to tell those stories. For example, Edison was described by the New York Times as a benefactor of the human race.
Yeah.
And then he got so famous because of the benefactions that he allowed all of us that by the time he was 60, if you drew his face on an envelope and you dropped it into a post box, it would be delivered to him in New Jersey.
Depending on your drawing skills, I'm gonna.
I think not all of them were trained with a sketch pad, but his face was that recognizable.
But the point being, these are men, and I'm sure leaving out a few women. Feel free to mention some there too that were held in high esteem of their work, their knowledge, their insight, and the benefits that they were trying to provide the human race.
Well, sure, but Chris, were Edison to come to life now, one of the things people loved about him and what made them call him a wizard, it's hard for us to recognize this, is actually the phonograph, because the phonograph could bring back people that you once loved who were gone. And there was an incredible emotional response people had to hearing a president after the president had left office and then left our terrestrial office. So Edison was seen as a great benefactor, but he also is a businessman. And were he to be brought back by some even more powerful technology than the phonograph, when he saw all of us walking around with miniature computers in our pockets that we also occasionally use for phone calls, he did perfect the telephone. And if he saw us using electricity to light our homes and to communicate as we are through steel and glass boxes through which we can mysteriously hear each other's voices, he would say, my plan worked. Basically, the reason that he perfected the light bulb was that he knew that the real money would be in selling electricity. And now that it is more than 150 years later, he would look out and he would see a whole planet that is always being sold the product that no one had found a way to sell before him.
Mm. Okay, so over time, though, does the germ of skepticism start to kind of infiltrate its way into science and technology? Where does the seeds of I like to call it doubt and denial, start to form?
I would say pride and convenience. I remember I was talking to an interviewer overseas, and he was, as people from Europe sometimes will, wanted to make Americans feel bad for being the real home team for denial. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, it's really an American phenomenon, isn't it? And I said, I'm just going to say two syllables to you, Darwin. Generally, we tend to deny stuff that is mathematically provable. And science is a way of finding equations for the world around us, equations that are as good in New York City as they are at the University of East Anglia when you were compiling temperature data. One of the hard things for us is when that data isn't, either attacks our pride the way Darwin did, or our convenience, basically, which is how global warming has affected us. It would be far better if it weren't true. And as Americans, and yeah, I'm falling into the European trap, as humans, we believe in firm positive thinking. The power of positive thinking is the wearing a tie way of saying wishing.
I would just add, perhaps it also attacks our pocketbook. It attacks
exactly. That's the convenience, Chris. It's an amazing deal that we've gotten from fuels that are based on earlier plant life. And when Edison and Tesla and Westinghouse were finding a way to wire every home with electricity and then sell the electricity, they weren't thinking, you know, there'll be a price to pay and we don't have to worry about it. It will be seven generations from now. They just thought, hey, this is going to make people's lives a lot easier, a lot cheaper, and a lot more convenient.
Right. And if Rockefeller were alive today, he would be a climate denialist too, I'm assuming.
It's an interesting thing about the oil companies. They always have fallbacks. With any large, you have to think of any large corporation as being like any Dr. Evil figure from a Bond movie. Mm-hmm. They always have an escape. They always have an escape pod somewhere. So Rockefeller, if he were still leading Standard Oil, he would think, okay, we are making vast sums of money from selling oil, but we also have sustainable fuels ready should and when that time comes.
So getting back to your book, you were writing something else when you read about the research in 1956 that was talking about climate change. So can you talk us through why you veered? Climate wasn't really one of the things that you were continuously writing about, so you kind of veered in this direction. And why was it so important for you then to pick up this project and run with it?
It caught up to all of us, didn't it? I mean, nobody really wants to be thinking about the weather beyond just figuring what's the appropriate way to dress and then what's the coolest way to dress appropriately. There's a great essayist named Elizabeth Hardwick, and she said that there are only two really solid reasons for writing anything. Those reasons are money and revenge. And for me, this was a revenge one. It was shocking to me to learn that in the 50s and then in the 70s, we knew everything that we know now about climate. We've refined it, but the basic data that we needed to make sort of smart decisions, we had. And that was staggering to me. I was researching a different project, and I came across articles from the 50s about just how prevalent the idea of climate change was. The Times ran, I think in a two-year period, the New York Times ran about eight or nine articles about, is the climate changing? No, the climate isn't changing. Yes, the climate is changing. Mm-hmm. Why the climate is changing? How industry can change the climate? And then finally, yes, the climate is really changing. And the one that really struck me was in 1956, Roger Revelle, who is the first great American climate scientist, he said in 50 years, this could have a violent effect on the Earth's climate. He didn't say it. I mean, he also said it there, but he didn't say it in a scientific journal. He didn't say it in EOS or the Journal of Applied Meteorology. He said that in Time magazine. And the title of the story wasn't abstruse either. The title of the story was One Big Greenhouse. And by the early 60s, the New York Times was saying that climate change was one of the key issues for people studying climate at that time. That was staggering. And then what I learned about the late 70s was even worse. We're used to the drug approval process, which takes about 10 or 20 years.
Right.
Roger Revelle is the most influential climate scientist of that time in America. One of the interesting things about getting to tell this great story is that the people who lie about science for a living, which I think is, it's a longer way, but it's a better way than saying deniers.
Yeah.
They always made it seem like it wasn't mainstream, but it was always the most mainstream people who just discovered this unfortunately inflexible equation. Roger Revelle said it was coming faster than people had expected. And so for about 10 or 20 years, people researched that to see if it was true. And by the mid-70s, the fruits of that research, well, not terribly appetizing fruits, started to come in. Did you guys see Oppenheimer? You know that's the Manhattan Project.
Right.
Is those were the cats he was herding, the doctorated cats. Gave us the atomic, gave us atomic weapons, which shortened World War II, and also gave us radar, which allowed for our commercial air traffic system. Mm-hmm. About 10 years later, the defense community was like, hey, let's get the band back together. So Manhattan Project veterans reformed as a group called JASON, and they were the people that you would turn to when there was a serious issue. So the reason that we didn't use atomic weapons in Vietnam was because the JASON said that would be a bad idea. And the Iron Dome that the Israelis used to protect Israeli citizens from missile attack, that is an outgrowth from the work they did recommending a digital battlefield and electronic weaponry. In the 70s, they of course turned to this because they were reading the same reports, and they sent a report to the White House saying, this is gonna happen. And again, it wasn't subtle and it wasn't secret. The head of that, the chairman of that report said to the New York Times in the spring of 1979, the government must start dealing with this immediately, and effects are going to start being felt by the 1990s. So President Carter turned to the National Academy of Sciences in the summer of 1979, 44 years ago now, 45 years ago, and said, is it going to happen? You, the National Academy of Sciences, you are the 2,000 best scientists in the country. You exist to answer questions like this. Do a thing like the Surgeon General's report on tobacco. Tell me if this is really going to happen and do we need to act? And the answer came back fast, and it was haunting to read. What the scientists wrote was that the results of their survey would be reassuring to scientists, because scientists, like the rest of us, don't like to be proved wrong, mm-hmm. but disturbing to policymakers. If the carbon dioxide release continues, this group finds no reason to doubt that climate changes will result, and no reason to believe those changes will be negligible. And that was presented to President Carter, to the White House, on July 29th, 1979.
We're speaking with David Lipsky, journalist and author of the book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. So I'm also thinking of James Hansen, who was also a major face in delivering this message, probably, what, the mid-80s or late 80s or so?
Chris, you know your stuff. It was June 23rd, 1988.
Yeah, so he's also plays a major role. But now it sounds like we're beginning the seeds of politicization here, where politics starts to get in the way. And you mentioned tobacco and other examples of doubt and denialism that start to work their way into this conversation. Who are some of the characters, would you say, that were on the other side of this issue?
The tobacco was a great farm team. Tobacco was like the preseason. They trained the two most famous deniers. Oh, I'd like to talk about that in a second. But the two most famous deniers are S. Fred Singer and
yes.
Frederick Seitz.
Yes.
And they are like a Laurel and Hardy team. Frederick Seitz, unfortunately, had been a past president of the National Academy of Sciences, which made him more expensive but also allowed what he said to have greater legitimacy. So when, remember the cult, the Moonies? It was a, sure. It was a cult led by Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who I'm always reminded by people who, experts who loved what I wrote about the cult, always remind me to say that he was defrocked as a minister, but it's hard not to use the honorific.
Right.
He learned what Republican pollsters also learned in the late 90s, which is if you have a debatable position, it turns out that Americans don't trust politicians that much. They don't trust mayors. They don't trust lawyers. What always came up highest on the polls were scientists. So when Reverend Moon needed two scientists to say that he wasn't leading a cult, it was the Freds. I've always loved writing about S. Fred Singer because of his tremendous flexibility as a science liar.
Right.
They came to him and they said, here is incontrovertible proof of sea level rise. And you can just picture him pausing and thinking it over. It's like a tough shot in tennis. How am I going to play it? And he came back with, the best evidence may be that it is a lowering of the land surface. I'm sorry, I'm laughing on the radio.
Right. But you're right. But you're right, David. I mean, you got an issue, and he would push back on it. And I just have a short list here. Tobacco, DDT, chlorofluorocarbons, and the ozone hole, leaded gasoline, asbestos. He was in, you know. And, of course, for a dollar, he would say whatever you want him to say.
Said that Joey was better than friends. When NBC needed somebody to say that the Joey Tribbiani show was as good as Friends, as Fred Singer said that his science showed it was better. I'm teasing, of course.
Right.
Even Fred Singer wouldn't lie about that.
But like you say, Fred Singer, Fred Seitz, they did a lot of damage, though. Let's be serious.
They did a lot of damage, but Chris, I've come to think about it this way, and it's kind of what I wanted to talk about with regard to a word like deniers or even the science. I think that what happened, there's a natural thing that happens with political issues. The idea is to stop natural forces, right? Natural equations like global warming from becoming political issues. But once they become political issues, we become tribal. And so we will use phrases like they're denying the science, and denial itself is a very fraught word. And then the science, the definite article means there is no other science. And it's true. But the thing is, it tells the listener, we don't really want you until you apologize. Mm. Now, that would be great if it were, but that hasn't worked as a way of getting Americans or just worldians, world citizens behind this issue. So it always makes me a little anxious. One of the things that I've thought about with the deniers, and I'm curious, there I am using it again, I'm curious if this matches your response too, is that they delayed it enough so that people now don't expect there to be a solution to climate change. And on some level, they don't think it's the problem that it is.
Well, I think I've heard you say that climate deniers are really successful at the art of distraction.
Yeah. They're, from the beginning, it was understood that they would lose. The tobacco people who trained them, they had understood that about their product, too. It's very strange often about people who produce dangerous products. They know. And the question is, how long can you keep it on the shelf before it's pulled, basically? So the idea was just to keep the argument going so you could keep selling, especially coal. But if I can give you... So, yes, it was just this, it was designed almost to get us used to it, to get us to a position that we're in now. But let me give you a sense of how complicated this is and why it's a great story, but why I also think that our approach to this, which is basically punitive towards the other side, doesn't work. We had our first really good news in the last couple of years in America. We have managed to cut our emissions. And one of the reasons that we've managed to cut our emissions at the same time that world emissions are up like 4% in the last couple of years. One reason we were able to cut our emissions is that we have stopped our tremendous use of coal. Around the turn of the century, 2005, 2006, coal use about 51% of all our electricity,
right.
All of our phones and Wi-Fi systems were from coal. Now it's down to 19%.
Yes.
Do you know what caused that?
Well, regulations and maybe the markets.
No, it's so much more ironic and interesting. Those things have certainly helped. It's fracking.
Yeah.
Fracking made natural gas cheaper than coal. So the power industry switched over to natural gas. Now, as people who care about the environment, I was always only one step away from going to protest people who were fracking. Because in a way, the idea of squirting high pressure water into fissures was like a little micro version of how we were thoughtlessly failing in our stewardship of the earth by releasing more carbon dioxide than the system could filter out. And yet, this technological solution to what is a technological problem is some of the only good news we've had for decades of, as regards cutting our emissions. That's how complicated it is, because mm-hmm. as people who care, we would have said, don't frack.
Yeah, you're right. And I remember that, you know, initially the great concerns. Yeah, there was both great celebration and also some skepticism and concerns on the environmental side about the damage that fracking can do. This was supposed to be a bridge, a temporary bridge to solar and wind. But you're right, it's settled in, and it's got a seat at the table now in our energy policy.
It is, and it's also been successful. So one of the best things that we've done as Americans for the planet is to grudgingly allow fracking. And the part of us, I think human beings are moral creatures. There's a great thing that Hemingway said about morality. Hey, two literary quotes. You didn't see that coming. Hemingway said that what's moral is what doesn't feel bad after. And doesn't that kind of match your experience? Basically, you know if your weekend was moral or if your telling off of a beloved friend was moral, if on some level you don't feel bad after. I think that there's some moral response we sometimes have to advanced technology, which is, how are we going to get away with this? Mm-hmm. Like a classic expression of that is that joke from the first half of the last century, if God had intended man to fly, et cetera.
Right.
And so I think that we have liked the idea on some level. It's been satisfying to us that our tremendously convenient way of life, that there would be a price to pay. And we want there to be a moral solution to what is just a technological problem, which right. is electricity is great, but if we produce a certain amount of carbon dioxide, it changes our temperature. It changes our climate to such a degree that it changes our temperature, which then changes our way of life in ways that we can't quite predict. So we're more comfortable with a moral solution. And I think that we actually are slightly anxious or a little restless if it turns out that the solution is technological after all.
Last couple minutes, gotta ask, what's the parrot? Who is the parrot? What is the igloo? I'm guessing igloo. James Inhofe, of course.
That's really funny. You're great.
Go ahead.
Yes, Chris. I'm laughing because it's a really smart question. And when I somehow heard
Thank
James
you.
Mountain Inhofe, Senator Inhofe's name coming.
Yes.
The parrot. So in 1956, when this issue becomes a live issue in America, and it's such a live issue that by the late 50s, the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, another great august science institution, mm-hmm. is proposing the first global warming solution, which is one tree for every car, 10 trees per truck, and 100 trees per airplane. Otherwise, we just roast. And that is, again, that's not in the science journals, that's in the Associated Press. In the 1950s, the Times, in October of 1956, just wrote about the basic things that we would recognize as the science, and then it said, the piece added, when it really kicks in, it could transform the Arctic regions into tropical jungles with tigers roaming about the underbrush and gaudy parrots squawking from the trees. And then this issue entered the great thunderdome of American politics. And when it came out in 2010, 60 years later, Senator James Mountain Inhofe. He was a Republican from Oklahoma, and he was the leader of the denial side of the conservative wing of the Republicans, and unfortunately was also head of the largest environmental working group in the Senate. Big snowfall in February in D.C., and on the D.C. Mall, he and his family build an igloo, and they put two signs on it, homemade signs. Al Gore's new home mm-hmm. as a way of trashing a politician who was trying to help on this. And the other sign was, honk if you heart global warming. And that is what we do in our tribal approach to even environmental questions. We take a parrot and we turn it into an igloo.
Well, we're out of time.
Well, this is a very heavy topic, though. And I do want to say that you approach this with humor, really. You take this pill with a lot of sugar in your book.
Claire, thank you. You see people reading. It's the summer. And while there are still beach towels that we can read on, I wanted to make something that would be as fun to read as Gone Girl. So to hear you say that is music to the ears of the me that made its fingers sore by keeping trying to make the story both correct and also thrilling and fun to read. So thank you very much for that, Claire.
Well, geez, I was going to head an even more darker existential route, as I always
do. As you usually do. Try to do this sugar
Claire,
here on this show, David.
Can read my body language. But I mean, Dave, we're going to have you back because we're staring down the barrel of an administration come November that will change everything. You know, in the three branches of government are going to become in one form or another climate deniers or climate doubters. And there is a whole nother conversation, David.
That is a big show and a big discussion as we head into...
I hope we don't have to have it, but I would love to join in. Yeah, it's funny. It seems sometimes you have to think, seems like the planet itself maybe doesn't want a speedy solution to this issue.
We'll leave it at that. Thank you, Dave. David Lipsky, author of the book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. David, website?
Website is just your local bookstore's website and then Amazon failing that website.
All right. David, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. We'll definitely have you back in the future.
Chris and Clara, couldn't have been more fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. And you are listening to KPCW and This Green Earth right here on your local community radio station. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
We are now speaking with Daniel Kinka, who is a senior wildlife restoration manager at American Prairie. Welcome, Daniel.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk with you because we have been talking a lot about rewilding and habitat
restoration
and protection on the show because it's obviously something near and dear to our hearts. So first off, why don't we start with American Prairie? Tell us about this reserve and then about your position there.
Yeah. So essentially what American Prairie is trying to do is piece together one of the largest protected areas for wildlife in North America outside of Alaska. We exist in kind of north central Montana region, surrounding a bunch of currently protected areas. And we've been at it since, for about 20 years now, piecing together public lands with private land acquisitions to, again, set aside that land for wildlife restoration, habitat restoration. Rewilding is a term that we use. And also public access. We want to make sure that these lands, the private lands anyways, are opened up for human access of a variety of kinds. And so public access is also a pillar of our mission. I'm the senior wildlife restoration manager for American Prairie, as you mentioned. Thank you. That basically means that I'm overseeing all of the rewilding that happens at American Prairie and also coordinating with our outside researchers. And I've been with the organization for about 6.5 years.
Well, let's start there with the first part of your position, and we'll get to the second part. But I want to know about some of the projects that you have done there that have been successful and what that meant for the land, the environment there when you do bring these species either back or help them to multiply.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of stuff that we do, and I don't have time to get into all of it, so I'll highlight the thing that I think maybe we're most associated with and maybe the rewilding practice that we engage in that moves the needle the most, and that is bison restoration. So bison are a keystone species, or an ecological engineer is a term that some of your listeners might be familiar with. It's also the nation's mammal. It's this very charismatic animal. It shows up on the badge of every National Park Service ranger. Mm-hmm. It's really important to the ecosystem and how they function, particularly in the Great Plains region. They are also, in this part of the state of Montana, considered livestock, not wildlife. They are not managed by the state wildlife agency. They're not managed by the federal wildlife agency. They're overseen by the Department of Livestock, and they are privately owned by American Prairie as an entity, unlike all other wildlife. This is kind of weird in terms of how we think about wildlife in this country, and certainly American Prairie thinks about the bison as a wildlife species, as a wild type animal, but legally they are not. What that does allow us to do, though, as a non-governmental organization, as a nonprofit organization, is to buy and own bison and bring them in, very similar to the way that a cattle producer would buy cattle and import them or breed them or whatever they need to do on the land that they own and operate, and put that towards, you know, a commodity production operation, right? Like, they raise cattle, they sell cattle, they make money that way. American Prairie operates in a similar way in the sense that we own bison, we raise bison, but we don't sell them for meat. We essentially use them as a restoration tool on the landscape. So when I say that I'm in the business of rewilding and my team is in the business of rewilding, often what we're doing is actually just bringing back nature's original rewilders, or maybe wilders is the better term, in the form of bison, and then allowing them to do the work. Because of the way bison graze, because of the way they operate on the landscape, they essentially make it a home for far more species and for more ecological processes than would exist without them. So simply by buying bison, bringing them onto the landscape, that takes us a long way towards our rewilding goals.
Right.
Talk to us about that role that they play in the ecosystem. Is it because they don't stay in one area for too long? They stay mobile, they do what they need to do for that, and then move on? How do they work in an ecosystem that is so beneficial?
Yeah, all of the above, Claire. Mm-hmm. And specifically, there's like a number of ways that bison qualify as an ecosystem engineer, but I'll focus on the one that is most often what you'll encounter. If you Google bison and ecosystem engineer, this is probably what you'll find. And it is the idea, bear with me, this is already complicated and it's harder to do in an audio medium, but they manage the structural diversity of the system. Mm-hmm. What the heck does that mean? Mm-hmm. It means that a grassland is a grassland, right? So let's just assume that all the plants, let's say there's 100 different species of plant, grass, forbs, whatever, that make up a prairie ecosystem in an amount of space, right? Let's just assume that's constant. That doesn't change, but when you put bison onto that, because of the way bison graze, and we're not trying to deliberately tell them, like cattle, like you graze here for these 2 months and then you move to this pasture for 6 weeks. When we can, we say, just be bison and do what bison do naturally. What they do in a big enough space is graze unevenly. So some areas get grazed very hard in a given year, some areas get completely missed in a given year, and some areas get lightly grazed in a given year. So what you get across this entire parcel, right, of the same species of grasses, plants, forbs, whatever, is a varying structural diversity. Patches within there that are ungrazed, very tall grass, patches that are very heavily grazed and are maybe almost all the way down to the dirt, and some that are kind of like medium grazed. And of course, they're not discrete categories. It's a continuum, right? From like heavily grazed to not grazed at all. And that's important for a number of other species, particularly migratory birds. Essentially, you've got birds that only want to be in the heavily grazed parts of that pasture. And you've got other birds that only want to be in the ungrazed parts of that pasture. And still other birds that want to be in the kind of lightly grazed part of that pasture. So what the bison are doing, just by virtue of the way they graze, the way they evolve to interact in this landscape, is taking a uniform landscape and making it heterogeneous or diverse in a way that accommodates more wildlife. So without bison, you get like the birds in the middle, basically, mm-hmm. under a typical cattle pasture management system. You just get the birds that like the kind of take half, leave half model. Again, there's more progressive ways of doing cattle management now, but this historical, classic way of doing this only accommodates the birds in the middle. With bison, or an animal that manages a little bit more ecologically mindedly, you have a full complement of these different types of habitat within that pasture, and therefore you get more and more different kinds of animals. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm curious as to what this land looked like prior to the reserve being established. I mean, we're talking 460,000 acres, almost 500,000. That's based on my math, that's like 750 or so square miles. It's a large tract of land. What was there before the reserve?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is it looks very similar to the way, you know, Lewis and Clark would have seen it when they came up the Missouri River in the very early 1800s, right? It looks very similar to what we hear about in the oral traditions of all the native peoples that would have called the region home historically and still do today. What's missing is the wildlife, right?
Yeah.
If you look at pictures, or more importantly, if you come to visit American Prairie, which is open for anybody to come and enjoy, you will see a landscape that, you know, with the exception of the barbed wire fences and the dirt roads, looks almost identical to what any early explorer or any early indigenous person would have recognized central Montana to be. Mm. The one difference is that all the large wildlife, anything bigger than a prairie dog, is either gone or reduced to ecologically insignificant populations. And what it has been replaced with, in most cases, is lots and lots of cattle. So the habitat looks the same way that the habitat used to do. The dark night skies are the same and as dark as they used to be. Mm-hmm. The quietude of central Montana is the same. The sunsets that you can see in Charlie Russell's paintings are the same. But what's missing is the elk and the bison and the pronghorn and the white-tailed deer and the mule deer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in significant numbers ecologically.
Mm. How many bison are we talking?
There's 900 bison, give or take, right now on two different management units, two different herds.
Plans for more?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We'd like to get to at least 5,000 bison before we can say, like, okay, we've made a pretty significant contribution to kind of bison restoration as a species across the continent.
Incredible. That's amazing. And we obviously right here in Utah have Antelope mm-hmm. Island where mm-hmm. you can go and see the bison. And obviously migratory birds play a big role in and what's happening in our ecosystem here. But moving past bison, it looks like you have a project for swift foxes. What are some of the other animals that you're trying to rewild in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And real quick, I'll just put a plug in for Antelope Island and also the Henry mm-hmm. Mountains herd of bison in Utah. I did my PhD at Utah State University. Nice. Go Aggies.
Fantastic.
Incredible place. I've been there many times. Yeah.
Great shout out. And I was just there actually last weekend. And it never ceases to amaze me when the bison are grazing and you just sit and watch. And there were a lot of calves. And just the family dynamic and what's happening out there is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's incredible. And a really accessible, easy way for, you know, the greater Salt Lake community to go see bison being, you know, mostly wild. But to your question, Claire, about what else are we rewilding, you mentioned swift fox, which is this endemic, so native to the region, little itty bitty fox of the Great Plains. I mean, we're talking about a fox that's smaller than a house cat in many cases, so a tiny little thing that was accidentally removed from the region historically. Basically, when people were persecuting wolves and coyotes in the region, the same stuff and the same techniques that kill those larger canids also kills the little ones. Mm. So they're not really a problem for agriculture. They don't really bother people at all. They mostly eat bugs and prairie dogs, but they were accidentally removed. So in collaboration with our research partners at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the Fort Belknap Indian Community, as well as a number of other environmental NGOs in the region, we're collaborating on a process to bring swift fox back to the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, a neighbor of American Prairies. And we've already seen some of those reintroduced foxes start to make their way into American Prairie, which is fantastic and a real success story. There's really only four animals that are missing from the American Prairie landscape, like not there at all. Four to six, I guess. It's the swift fox, the black-footed ferret, the wolf and the grizzly bear, bison, if you count wild bison that aren't constrained behind a fence, and maybe river otters, but frankly, we don't know a whole lot about what was here since those would have been trapped out very, very early. Mm. So the kind of like standard rewilding, the kind that I think most people imagine when they close their eyes of like a biologist, an intrepid biologist, like capturing an animal, putting it in some kind of cage and driving it to a new spot and dropping it off in that new spot. That's not really the kind of rewilding that we're primarily engaged with. A lot of these wildlife, like swift fox and black-footed ferrets and bison, are actually, if you squint, you can find them on the map. They're just like vanishingly few. They're like insignificant numbers. American Prairie is really more about turning the volume up on wildlife. Most of our animals are there. There's just too little of everything. So the question is, how do you make more of everything, more than it is about how you do relocation or translocation type of rewilding?
We're speaking with Daniel Kinka. He's the Senior Wildlife Restoration Manager at American Prairie. And American Prairie is a prairie-based nature reserve of almost 500,000 acres located in central Montana. So Daniel, you have your fans, I'm sure.
We do.
But is there pushback on your efforts from, say, local ranchers? Are there concerns with respect to an American prairie or a reserve like this?
Of course. Yeah. Some more justified than others, some more fact and evidence-based than others. But American Prairie is presenting a new way of managing land and way of thinking about land in the American West than has typically been engaged in the last 150 years. It's exciting. It's audacious. Mm-hmm. It's meaningful for people and wildlife across the continent. And we have many, many supporters that appreciate the work that we're doing, some of whom are supporting the work that we're doing financially. We're almost entirely driven by philanthropic donations. But of course, being something new and novel always, I think, you know, puts up people's antennas a little bit. Mm-hmm. It attracts attention, particularly in, you know, relatively conservative spaces like agricultural land, or typically seen as agricultural land throughout the Great Plains or the Northern Great Plains. And so sometimes we hear pushback. We're a different idea. We look very different. I live out on American Prairie, and certainly I didn't grow up the way that some of my neighbors, my ranching neighbors, grew up. I think we draw attention for that reason, but we also put enormous amount of resources and time into spending time with those neighbors and more distant neighbors to explain kind of what the mission of American Prairie is and why we don't see ourselves in any way as a threat to traditional agriculture, either at the, you know, family coffee table level or at the kind of mid-economic level in terms of like regional tax bases, county level politics, that sort of thing. At the end of the day, even 500,000 acres of American prairie is a very small minority of the total land base in the 7 counties that we operate. And even things like bison, you know, there's about 900 bison on American prairie right now. There's like 7,000 cattle grazing just on American prairie, not to mention the 500,000 cattle grazing in those 7 counties. So American prairie is certainly changing what is available to do and experience in southern Phillips County and some of these other counties in Montana, diversifying, we hope, you know, things to do, things to see, economic, you know, revenue streams, economic opportunities for the communities in the region. But that's different. And different is, I think, always viewed with some skepticism, whether it's in Montana or in Botswana.
Yeah, you're right.
Absolutely. Well, you also act as a liaison to scientists who are conducting research on the reserve. What does that mean? What type of research are they conducting, and why will that be helpful for us in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I appreciate it because it gives me a chance to shout out some of my close partners. I did mention the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute already. They are not our only science partner, but they are our primary science partner. We work with graduate students and researchers from both Montana universities and a number of other universities throughout the country. But Smithsonian and the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute are really kind of the research arm of American Prairie. We decided a long time ago that, like, we wanted to be in the business of rewilding public access, buying land for the sake of conservation, not research. That's a different thing, and we didn't want to throw our hat in, and we didn't want to try and reproduce the good work of really powerful scientists. We'd rather partner with them, and who better to partner with than the, you know, world-class scientists at Smithsonian. And so what that means is I work very closely with a number of scientists who are doing the research that informs our management practices. Me and the rest of the staff at American Prairie, our job is to rewild the landscape, steward the resource, the habitat, and manage that for public access. We want to do that based on the best available science. And much of that science has already been done. There are libraries full of graduate dissertations and published research papers and textbooks, et cetera, on prairie ecology. But there's a lot of questions that we still don't know the answers to, or don't have the specific answers that we would like as managers to do our work. And that's where Smithsonian comes in. They are doing work on primary prairie ecology, so just answering fundamental questions about how prairies work, how they are being affected by climate change, all kinds of different other big high-level research questions like that. But also in that process, answering specific management questions that we have about how to do our job to the best of our abilities as rewilders. And that's That's just something that we cannot do on our own. And so the support from Smithsonian and the other research partners that we have is very welcome.
And doing a nod back to our first guest, who was talking about climate change and how obviously there's a ripple effect to all of us for climate change. Yeah. And when you have these scientists who are working to show how it is affecting our Earth and how why we should care.
Yeah.
I think places like American Prairie can lend a voice to that argument, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. There's two kind of like big natural, like essentially existential threats going on right now. And right. climate change is one of them, which everybody's familiar with. And then there's the biodiversity loss crisis, which I think most people are at least somewhat aware of, although it doesn't typically get the same attention as the climate crisis. Those are interlinked crises, certainly. And American Prairie is really designed to address the biodiversity loss crisis in North America. We kind of lost the appetite for making big national parks sometime around the 1950s after we made Grand Teton National Park. We still make them, but they're very small. We never really made a prairie park, certainly not one big enough to house the full complement of prairie ecology. And the beautiful menageries of wildlife that North Americans should be heir to is largely missing. There is nowhere, really, at scale that you can go out on a grassland landscape and see big herds of bison being followed by pronghorn and wolves and grizzly bears and elk grazing and sage grouse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's just gone. And so we think we can bring that back, which is a way of addressing the biodiversity loss crisis. But one of the cool things that we increasingly are learning more about is that prairies are really, really good at sequestering carbon, grasslands, to provide a tremendous service in terms of like storing away these greenhouse gases underground. Not as much as forests do. There's just like less of a grass than there is of a tree by weight, and so less places to put carbon, but grasses bury their carbon underground in their roots. Our prairie grasses may only be 12 inches tall above ground, but their root systems can be 8 to 10 feet deep. And so what that means is when a forest burns, all that carbon goes right back into the air and you're kind of back at square one. Whereas when a prairie burns, the grass burns, sure, but its roots remain intact underground. And so while it may not sequester as much carbon as a forest does, it looks like a more stable long-term storage place for it, especially as fire return cycles increase in the face of climate change. Right. So for this and other reasons, we're finding that like what we're doing at American Prairie is not only supporting the rewilding of the continent, the Northern Great Plains anyways, but also is contributing to, you know, keeping carbon in the ground so that it's not contributing to greenhouse gases and global warming.
We got to wrap up, unfortunately. Daniel Kinka, he's the Senior Wildlife Restoration Manager at American Prairie. Daniel, website for people to go to learn more and probably see some spectacular photos.
Wonderful photos. Okay. There's even a film about the fox. I'm in love. What is the website?
Yeah, it's AmericanPrairie.org.
Ah.
And prairie, if you're like me, and even after 6.5 years, can't remember how to spell it, it's P-R-A-I-R-I-E. AmericanPrairie.org.
Yes.
You can learn a lot more about us there.
Daniel Kinka, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. We will be back in touch.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right.
Yeah, my pleasure. Take care.
Thank you, too.